the sake of the recording, if we're being recorded, my name is Franz Schemmel. I'm the pastor at Messiah Lutheran Church in Weatherford, Texas. I'm glad to be here. All right, we are at Acts of the Apostles, chapter 11, verse 27. At that time, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and predicted by the Spirit that there would be a severe famine over all the world. And this took place during the reign of Claudius. The disciples determined that according to their ability, each would send relief to the believers living in Judea. This they did, sending it to the elders by Barnabas and Saul. So, there's a prediction of famine by the Spirit. If you read through it, it's kind of fun reading through the book of Acts. The church seems like they make a lot of their decisions based on like a prophetic vision. And one wonders exactly what do they mean by that? You know, is it something that we're familiar with? You know, most of the time at a church council meeting, in my experience, people are not, they don't come and say, well, Pastor, you know, I had a vision, and, you know, and on that basis, we should have this action. Or if they do say that, those are the people that we say, that was very nice. Now, back to business, you know, the church councils are kind of like hard-nosed, it seems like. They are trying to be practical. I always like when they say, we got to run this church like a business. And I go like, it's not possible to run it like a business. But that'd be a part of our thinking today. But the... It is also interesting that there's a sympathy that's felt. They see a famine that's coming, and they, you know, the idea rises up right away without too much question. Well, we need to take up a collection. We need to help each other. So like you were saying just before, you're asking Anne. She's talking about the situation of the Palestinian Christians and their various difficulties. And you ask then,
what can we do?
What can we do? What can we do to help them? Yeah. So then she has some ideas, you know, about various ways with scholarships and this and that. And if you look into further, there are different things. It's nice to go visit them because they feel a lot of times alone and isolated and that nobody hears them. And that, you know, and you are, if you stick up for Palestinians, you are a person who is swimming against the tide right now that people wonder about you. But on the other hand, I think the gospel says we're supposed to look out for those who are the marginalized, not just for those who are the most powerful. So, and we see an example here that Judean Christians are in trouble, so the rest want to do something. Then turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. I wanted to look at chapters 8 and 9 here. Paul is trying to write to the Corinthians to invite them to and command them and cajole them and needle them to get on board with this offering that he's going to come and take for the saints that are back in Jerusalem. And this is a couple chapters that are sometimes used by the stewardship committee in your congregation. And I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that. But Paul's got a lot of motivations here that he puts out there to try to, like I say, to get something out of them as far as this offering. So somebody jump in and start reading it, chapter 8:1. And if I have some remarks, which I will, I'll stop you.
We want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia. For during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For as I can testify, they voluntarily gave according to their means and even beyond their means, begging us earnestly for the privilege of sharing in this ministry to the saints. And this not merely as we expected. They gave themselves first to the Lord, and by the will of God to us.
Stop right there. Notice what Paul's thinking about the, he's saying, isn't it great to just have the opportunity to be able to help? And that these churches in Macedonia, that they were blessed with the privilege of it. And also they gave themselves to God and then gave themselves to us. So how do you rate this motivation? I'm saying you're hearing the stewardship sermon here. Is this a motivating thought? That it's a privilege to be able to be a part of something. To be able to be in the position. Yes.
Well, I think it's clearly counterintuitive. Most of us get nervous when we know somebody's going to hit us up.
Yes.
but we also like the idea of being generous. It's just getting there. It's sometimes difficult. Sometimes kind of greasing the skids like Paul's doing here. Showing that generosity actually is something that enlarges us.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you give, you often get far more in return. It leads to different things. But the other thing, I think often we have the problem of not accepting when others give. It's much easier to give than to receive something from somebody else.
Well, it's more blessed to give than to receive, but also easier sometimes to give than to receive.
Yeah.
Well, I have my daughter has went to high school, and then they've been friends ever since. With a Pakistani girl, and her mother is a very kind and generous person. And she said to me something I thought was very nice once. She said, I always am grateful, and I hope I can always have a life where my hand is like this, not like this. So she was considering, she looked at her life as if she is in a position to be able to help somebody. That's a good position to be in, as opposed to being on the other side.
I think the frustrating thing, not only the difficult thing, there are so many causes.
True, yeah.
You have to make your choices.
On the other hand, I think that Paul's also saying that we all have our hands like this all the time. Otherwise, we have nothing to give.
Ah. You mean like this? You mean in praise? Or
well,
this in
gratitude.
In gratitude, yeah, absolutely, yeah, in gratitude, yeah.
And to remember that we aren't by nature rich. Everything that we have is a gift.
Yes.
For a purpose.
What do you have that you have not received, he writes, to the Corinthians elsewhere.
I could see this going very poorly too, though. I mean, for someone who says it's a privilege to give to our, organization, and
all right,
depending on the motivation and where people are coming from, that could be.
Now, do you have to fundraise for this campus ministry that you're involved?
Yes and no.
All right.
I don't personally do
you
it.
You don't personally do it. All right.
So, I actually get the. Which has been nice. I've been traveling to all our congregations in the district, and when I come and visit, I say, I'm not asking for money. I don't want your money. I just see a sigh of relief going from the congregation. So.
But you're supposed to say, but of course, if you'd like, if you're motivated to give on the basis of my visit, well, that would be good for me. Let's continue. Read on here.
That we might urge Titus that as he had already made a beginning, so he should also complete this generous undertaking among you. Now as you excel in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in utmost eagerness, and in our love for you, so we want you to excel also in this generous undertaking.
I have just a thought on that. There was somebody teaching about stewardship one time to me. There's a tight little string that runs between the Christian's heart and his wallet. And when someone begins plucking on that string, they don't always like the tune that it makes. Well, anyway, Titus here, he's the fundraiser. He's the one, he's coming in there, and he is there maybe already. And he's the head of the stewardship committee. And Paul is saying, you know, you need to help him out. And also this, that they have so much, because the Corinthians, if you read 1 Corinthians, part of the conflict they have among themselves is like, who is the most spiritual? You know, is it those that are the tongue speakers or the prophets or those who feel like they have some special, you know, such a great theology that they can go to the idol temple and eat food with the idol temple and their idol temple friends, and it doesn't, you know, faze them because they know the idols are nothing, you know. And they're so smart about that. And they mock those among their friends who won't go because they're, like, nervous, saying, well, I should be faithful to Christ. I shouldn't be going to the idol temple. Well, so he's saying, you've got everything. You have all this. Well, let's, you know, move to the next level, which would be also showing generosity. Proceed. Maybe another reader, or you can. You're doing great.
Verse 8.
Verse 8. Yes, and you're supposed to say, can I interject something here? This is a mathematician over here. I took a, is there a topic in math called linear algebra?
Yes.
And matrices?
Matrices, yeah.
Yes, anyway. So I'm sitting there in this math class. This is where I knew I was over my head, that I'd gone as far in math as I needed to go. Here's a professor, and he is, you know, that clearly lost in the world of mathematics. And he's trying to do a transformation of a matrix, you know, from here to here, and he's working it out, you know, one, you know, thing at a time, and then he's going 2 + 2. And he's thinking hard about it, 2 + 2. He's a math professor, you know? Then he goes, okay, in this case, he says 4. In this case, 4. It could be something else. See, there you go. So when you say 8 comes after 7, I would thought you might say, well, in this case. Yeah.
One of the problems is that people are your mathematician and they elect you treasurer and they don't realize you can't add.
Yeah. You can just think about the meaning of addition, you know? Like, what does it mean to add? You know?
I do not say this as a command, but I am testing the genuineness of your love against the earnestness of others. For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was poor, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich.
Let's stop right there for a second. I really like this image. Though he was rich, he became poor for your sake. But is this a motivator? It's a little bit of a guilt trip, kind of. I mean, you could take it that way, I guess. I mean, look at Jesus. He had everything, and then he became poor so that you could have everything. Would that motivate you to... Well, yeah. What do you think? When you're thinking about it, you're putting your offering in the plate, or somebody appeals to a cause, just say, well, what would Jesus do? You know? I don't know, nobody's jumping up and liking this.
Jesus would ask somebody else for a coin.
Maybe so, yeah, I don't have any money. That's interesting. One thing I noticed in Texas, by the way, as far as the people for a long time were wearing the What Would Jesus Do bracelets. And they wore them up till 9/11. And then I noticed they disappeared. And in the popular culture, nobody was saying anymore, what would Jesus do? Because he does have remarks about turning the other cheek, you know, and not taking revenge. So anyway. And I did hear this on the radio. We have a lot of right-wing radio down in Texas. And anyway, one guy was saying that he was certain that Jesus would be opposed to any kind of a national health care system.
Oh, my, I don't know about that.
Right, because he said, don't you know the Bible verse where Jesus says, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, but teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime? And I thought, I don't think that's in the Bible. You know, it might be good advice, but I don't think it's a word from Jesus. Anyway, but he had...
What does that have to do with health care?
Yeah, and what does that have to do with health care? Exactly. So, anyway, it is an image of... this is also in Philippians, though, this idea that that Christ is with God and that he humbles himself and becomes obedient unto death. And that is a way of thinking about then we would be imitators of Christ. We'd have some of the same view. That our life would not be about accumulation. That would instead the things that would be of most satisfaction to us would be where we had made a contribution, and less so about how we've made an accumulation. I will say that it is, for example, in the ELCA and the, when the ALC and the LCA were merging, things were just rocking along, you know, we love all the, you know, the LCA people, and they love us, and et cetera, and I come from the ALC, the LCA pastors, they're a little bit, you know, snooty, you know, but we could probably put up with them, you know, and all join together. Because the LCA defined itself as a union of pastors and congregations, whereas the ALC defined itself as a union of congregations. Didn't mention the pastors as a special group. So anyway, so things, like I say, were rocking right along until all of a sudden it became clear, the financial people came forward and said, well, the ALC has been more conservative with their pension contributions, and they are fully funded. But the LCA is funding pensions out of current offerings.
Oops.
Oops. So there was a big question. How can we possibly merge those two things? And it's interesting. The whole, you know, aspect of Christian unity and bringing things together was based on the pension plans and the security of the pension plans of the clergy.
Yeah. Is there a problem with that?
So they had to bring in the actuaries, you know, and work something out. And they, you know, they made some, anyway, I don't know that is that it's really well known, that little conflict, but it is interesting to me that when I look in the Bible to see who the Lutheran ministers are most like, I don't usually see Jesus. I usually see the Pharisees, and maybe more likely, you know, Pharisees who want to be, have the money of the Sadducees. So, it's an embarrassing thing. But I think our the witness here that we have about Jesus, if you see some people who seem to have no fear about using their money and their time and their life for the sake of generosity to others, it's a beautiful thing when you see that. Let's proceed here. Verse 10. And in this matter, someone help me.
And in this matter, I am giving my advice. It is appropriate for you who began last year not only to do something, but even to desire to do something. Now finish doing it so that your eagerness may be matched by completing it according to your means. For if the eagerness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has done, not according to what one does not have.
All right, I think that's a nice verse. You know, if you think about yourself, I feel it's important for people to practice generosity no matter what their level of income. I have a son who argues with me about that. Because he says, I don't make enough money yet to start thinking about giving any money away. He's pushing 40. So so My point here is a little bit different than Paul's point. Paul's point is that however poor you are, if you have even a little something, okay. And I think maybe he has in mind, we don't know for sure how much he knows about the stories of Jesus. Sometimes he quotes the Lord. But, you know, like the widow's mite, she has two pennies, puts that in. Doesn't seem like anything compared to the big gifts, the big donors. Does it bother you if you, you know, Ann and I like to go to the symphony. And in the symphony, they're raising money in the secular world. And when you open the, you know, the book of the symphony, then it always has, you know, like the top tier balcony givers, you know. They're like, they've got like, you know, the one level of giving, and then the 5 to 10,000 annually, they've got another set.
Yeah, well, I've always wondered about that. Because, you know, I give money to all these other organizations, and the church is so secretive about everything.
Yes.
And, you know, I once belonged to a parish, which in just making their annual report, they listed all their income, which was name by name of what everybody gave.
Did you like that or not?
It didn't bother me.
Okay.
And there was a lot of variation. And so, you know, I go to the church and we have this cantata series. And we'll do it for the cantata series. We'll raise money for that. And here will be, you know, the givers from $0 to $50 and $50 to $100. But when it comes to the general church contribution, there's nothing. And another thing that bothers me a little bit about this is that our church is always behind in this budget. But we have one pretty wealthy member. And this guy keeps anonymously, and everybody knows who he is.
Yeah.
Making challenge grants.
Oh.
You know, if you give so much, if the congregation will raise $10,000, you know, there'll be a $10,000. And that seems like an awfully poor motive for giving to the church to me.
It's one of Paul's motives here. We'll run across, you know, like, these guys see what they did. Okay, now I'll see if you can match them. But I'm not sure it's his best argument. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. And I've often wondered about that, why we were so secretive talking about this. And on the, you know, I came from this background where when I was a young child, well, we always, you know, tied, and it's a habit really never got out of.
Yeah.
Including days when I was a graduate student, wasn't making any money at all. And it always seemed to work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked, and now, you know, all the way through putting kids to college and all that kind of stuff. And it's almost harder now, you know, that all this stuff's behind and I have a comfortable pension to, you know, to continue the practice. It was really kind of easy when we didn't have very much. And that's always sort of been kind of a strange thought for me.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, according to the data, those of low income in America give away a higher percentage of their income than those at the highest level. And I think that is so. But you were taught, let's go back to this tithing thing. Your father, he was a Lutheran pastor, right?
Yeah.
But he taught you tithing?
Well, somehow it came from someplace, yeah. That we just started that, and somehow or other my wife was also kind of that. And so we just started that practice.
I remember you used to make us give a third of our income as kids because we got
15
cents for a
nickel. You had to give a nickel. Wow, okay. Be careful what you say when the daughter sits next to you.
I want to know. And now I get $3 each week.
Well, I don't know where it happened, but it was just a practice we continued over the years.
Yeah.
And it never seemed to, and I can remember, you know, months where we ran out of money because we're just out of graduate school, had a family, you know, beginning teachers don't make that much. But it still seemed to work.
Yeah.
And that's a...
Do we have any other testimonials about your giving? Yes.
Well, I would say I come from the same mold in my growing up as you with the tithing. My whole life experience has been so blessed just because, first off, that was what we did, even in grad school and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I have a little anecdote now. I belong to one of the churches I belong to.
Oh, yeah, you get two churches because you have two houses. Okay.
In Texas, we worship in a former dairy barn. And to a number of pastors, retired or pastors in the area. They kind of like what we are because we're at that point where we're open to anybody and everybody, and we're kind of a group of motley people.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a wonderful financial situation, and I laugh, I say to some people I know very well, oh, well, it's not a problem. We have four or five pastors who are members, and you know they tithe, so we have a big budget. And when we have our stewardship or what have you, I mean, we could go from part-time pastor now to three-fourths-time pastor,
mm-hmm,
with our small little group of 40 or 50 people. But the secret is that this feeling of giving is there, embedded in our lifetime histories.
Mm-hmm.
And it carries through.
And you personally were taught at some point about who taught you to be a tither?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
Oh, my father was a pastor.
I see. Okay.
We need more PKs.
We need more PKs in the church. That's right.
We have four little congregations in Western Minnesota, you know, and we grew up where they went around the altar and put the offering in for the pastor three, four times a year, and then we'd all come home and collect and count the money out of our bank.
Wow.
That was our extra little kid,
extra.
You know.
Wow.
And so we learned to.
Yes, sir.
You know, this idea about that you mentioned about publishing the giving of people in the church. The argument against that, of course, is, well, this is between me and God.
Yeah,
right.
And it's none of your business. You know, it's between me and God. Well, you know, in a sense, it's not just between me and God. We are a community of people that are a worshiping community. And like it says in Acts, you know, everything was given in common. And I'm not saying we need to do that, but at least we need to recognize that as a community, we have a responsibility to our brothers and sisters to make sure that there is enough to do the mission of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
In talking about posting, amounts and things, and also about people kind of, older people in the congregation maybe being good examples for younger people who need to learn this,
mm-hmm,
like 40-something. About 25 years ago, my mother, who's a member of a large congregation in Seattle, my mother and my father, she went, and they posted the annual giving of each household by offering envelope number, you know, so you didn't have your name up there.
Mm-hmm.
You go look at your number.
Yes.
And they had their annual budget meeting, and my mother stood up in the meeting. She wasn't very shy anyway, but she stood up and she said, I looked at that list and I found out that my husband and I are the 11th largest givers in this large congregation. She said, I think that's just terrible. We're retired and we live on a fixed income, and all of you people that are out there earning money can give a lot more than we can.
Wow.
So it's sometimes, you know, and I think that a lot of people pay attention to that.
All
you know,
right.
And they just went, instead of trying to figure this out. Yeah, that's good. So there's some benefit.
One of the things that I would say too, speaking from a younger generation, is that younger people aren't thinking that the church is their sole place to give.
Uh-huh.
You know, that in fact they're not becoming members of churches either. They're in fact fighting the idea of why is membership so important. I led a membership class for our church during its vacancy, and I had to ask myself, why is membership so important? Is it just voting rights? Or why can't other people who are regular, I mean, we've had regular people of the congregation that have been going for 15 years, but they've never become a member. Or just young people that just don't want to become. They fight against that. And so with the financial giving, they may have one or two compassion children or something that they're supporting, or supporting whatever kind of comes along, and they're not maybe even giving anything at all to the church.
But I don't
and
think
yet
anybody
giving.
Here has said that that's the only place they're giving.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
We all give to other things.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that might be why, you know, if you have zero under, you know, a lot of these young people, in fact, statistics, well, some years ago anyway, it said that the giving power of one older member of the congregation needs to be brought up by about six younger people. And but it's specifically for that congregation. So you might say, why aren't people giving? But they're just not giving to the church. They're giving to all these other organizations.
Paul, you had your hand.
I just wonder what the connection that might be between our discussion here and taxes. If you render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, we sort of have the same problem with taxes. People don't want to pay taxes, but we would like the benefits that we get from people who do pay taxes. Yeah. And it seems to be a conundrum.
There is a conundrum, and that's true, I think, in church as well. People expect the church to be there, you know, but do they feel a connection to it, that it's part of their responsibility that it is there? That's following up on your point here, Andy. Let's continue on. Verse 13. Someone jump in.
I'm sorry. I do not mean that there should be a relief for others and pressure on you, but it's a question of a fair balance between your present abundance and their need, so that their abundance may be for your need, in order that there may be a fair balance. As it is written, the one who had much did not have too much, and the one who had little did not have too little.
All right. Paul has this idea that the body of believers, they are one, that they have a unity. And that, like he writes in his first letter to the Corinthians, you know, if one part of the body's hurting, the whole rest, you know, if you hit your thumb with a hammer, then the whole body responds. And I think he's using that kind of thought here, that there is a connection between them, and that we have an obligation to one another to care about each other in this way. And I wondered, your question at the beginning, what can I do to help the Palestinians? At what level is that? Do we have a consciousness of that? And how does that actually work out? Like, if the young people are not contributing to a church, do they feel a sense of obligation to, or a sense of community to some place or somebody in the world, that their need, you know, they feel it as if it's their own trouble?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think some of it is because they don't associate themselves wholly with one thing. That they connect with this organization or something for some time, and then they move over here, and they don't find that. Even churches, I mean, you'll find that young people often go to maybe two churches or something. They may go to a big mega church for the worship service, and then they still find themselves going to this other little church for the small group ministry or something like that. So it's kind of challenging to put your thumb on, I guess.
I think a lot of it has to do with, we see this throughout our society, it's an issue of commitment. We are reluctant to commit ourselves. We see it in marriage, we see it in churches, we see it in employers and employees. There just is not a sense of commitment, I think, and that has a lot to do with it.
Do we have, I mean, what is the nature of the commitment? Like all of you here from Central Lutheran, for example. Raise your hands. You always get to raise your hands. Okay. You're part of this congregation. What obligation, if you had to describe it, what is your obligation to your fellow members at Central Lutheran Church?
We have a large homeless program. It's called the Restoration Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a fair amount of money given to that, certainly many volunteer hours.
Mm-hmm.
We give food, we give clothes, counseling. So that's one commitment.
So you feel a commitment to your neighborhood in that way,
exactly.
Your downtown congregation, inner city. Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a group that's very focused on foreign mission.
Uh-huh. So you maintain commitments to your overseas?
Missionaries, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're also committed to our seminarians, and that we try to provide for them financial support.
Okay.
As the be with them.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a nursing center. About 25 years ago, the head of the nursing program at Augustana College, thought it would be a good idea if the young nurses could actually serve the homeless in clinics. It would be a good experience. And she thought, well, this is an idea, I better talk to the president or the dean. And they said, oh, this is great, just find a room and set it up. Well, when she asked around Augsburg, they said, do you have a budget? And so she wasn't able to find space in Augsburg. And then it occurred to her, maybe some churches would be interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was surprising. She, 4 or 5 years, there were churches, well, I don't know whether we want these people, you know, it's kind of difficult to have these odoriferous people coming in and so forth. And but eventually, the Council of Central worked out an arrangement where during the week, the nurses provide services to the homeless. And on Sunday, the parishioners can go in and get their blood pressure and temperatures taken, and children with colds can be taken in. So it's a wonderful outreach program.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing, it was money at the beginning that made it difficult to get the whole thing started.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was back to the homeless program that you have also over here. You're saying that the churches beg now for the chance to participate? Or that that there's a blessing to those who participate in the homeless feeding problem.
Yeah, we have actually probably more volunteers than we can handle sometimes.
Yeah. The this question of like the unity and our obligation to, I think in general there's a sense in the scriptures. Of course, they rise out of the experience of those traveling Bedouin kind of communities, kind of like Abraham. Where in a community like that, there's no rich and poor, really. You know the movie, Lawrence of Arabia? Mm-hmm. And Lawrence is in the tent of this guy, Auda. And he's kind of trying to get Auda to come on board with his, you know, plan to attack the Turks. And anyway, so he's teasing him a little bit about how he takes money from the Turks. And Auda kind of gets his back up, you know, and then he starts saying, you know, I have all these scars in battle, you know, and I have these people pay tribute to me and these pay tribute. He said, I am a rich man, yet I am poor because I am a river to my people. He said, well, he has the idea that, you know, it's just built into his brain that if you have, then you have an obligation to care for all those in that community. So you take those kind of, that kind of an ethic, and then in the Bible you move it to like where you have cities and towns where you get social stratification. Then the prophets, the Old Testament prophets who are still thinking like these Bedouin people, they go to the city and they look around and say, well, this is terrible. You know, you've got some people who are living these lives of ease and other people being sold for a pair of shoes. And how can you say that is the people of God? So there is this, I think, and you find it in Jesus and here in Paul, a sense that the suffering of your neighbor puts a claim on you somehow, just automatically, that we're all in this together. So in the healthcare debate, that's part of it, I think, in our country right now. You know, I'll just show my cards on that. I feel like you shouldn't have to, I mean, the fact that you exist in this country ought to mean that you can get some health care, you know, in the way we've concluded it about if you're a child in this country, you can go to school, and we'll make it possible somehow for you to, you know, we have a good public education system. But I think that's part of, that's the ethic, at least where I'm coming from, is that we do have an obligation to care for each other, and that if I would have, you know, a bunch of wealth, and, you know, my neighbor sits there with nothing, it mocks me, you know, to be in that position. Yeah.
I'm really intrigued a lot, not only about specifically what Andy said, but about the different paradigm for the way in which people commit themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we get, you know, well, we used to, I remember having to buy a whole album to get a song.
Yeah.
I can download a tune at a time.
Right. Still cost you 99 cents.
I mean, it's like we're multitasking all kinds of things, not just the day-to-day activities, but we're multitasking our spirituality, the commitments to various things, and we pick and choose. And we, there is no one-stop shopping anymore for our spiritual life.
Right. That bodes ill for our congregations, I think.
Well, either that or it bodes ill for the way that we've always done things.
Yeah. So we have to maybe, we have to think hard, yeah.
Well, it's happening to us. We, you know, yep. The way that we adapt to a different paradigm is probably going to say a lot about how well we do.
Yeah. One of the things that I would suggest, too, is this idea of a church building. We're very used to that and comfortable with that. But I wonder, you know, how long that will stay together. For instance, again, coming from a youth perspective, there's a community in Fremont in Seattle called Church of the Apostle, CODA, and they have a very, just an incredible emerging style worship where they incorporate old and new. And for some time, they were just trying to make that work. They were getting support from the Episcopal and Lutheran Church and stuff. And then they decided that they were growing enough that they could purchase the building that they were in. Well, they purchase it, and now all of a sudden they see this exodus of their members.
Uh-huh.
Everything that their membership was made up of a lot of disillusioned, marginalized Christians, people who were ready to give up on God. And they loved that community. They loved the church. But as soon as it became political to them, then they find that they're just struggling. They have a lot of visitors coming, but they don't have a core group of, well, they still have a core group of members, but not to the effect, I mean, they were growing, and then all of a sudden when they bought that building, when they started making the pitches for offering and stuff, boom, the people scattered, and they said, that's
part of the old paradigm. That's been the abbess of that congregation. Used to be the director of the assistant director of worship at the ELCA. And that whole paradigm of, well, you get to a certain point and then you grow up and you start paying for things.
I'm so glad to hear that, because that's almost the point we are with our dairy barn. And we're just at the point now, are we going to get land and are we going to build?
See, and a lot of places would say, don't even worry about the building. Just stay where you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real challenge. Even the role of the pastor is changing. I mean, why bother supporting a pastor who you try and force them to do all these different things when they're not always good at doing all these? You know, they're not always the best counselor, or they're not always the best preacher.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm looking towards the ministry, but these are questions that I wonder. Why should I be stepping into a ministry where I feel is becoming inadequate and obsolete, maybe even? I don't know.
It's a good question.
I belong to a congregation in Minneapolis that lost its building to the freeway in the 1960s and they never built another building. We have moved from place to place to place. We have a building where we have offices, but other than that, we are in the community. We call ourselves a church without walls, and we are in an immigrant population, and it really has made a huge difference because, you know, we don't have a furnace that dies in the dead of winter. But it's interesting because there are pressures saying, why don't you build a building? You know, why don't you go build a building? But we are the only Christian worshiping congregation left in that community. It's mostly East Africans, Somali community. It's a challenge, but it's an interesting experience to me.
I will, Dick, I'll come to you in a second, but let me make the comment. These two chapters here, which are used, as I say, in congregations for stewardship, you know, program, or even for building fund, but you can read through the whole New Testament, and you don't see any appeals from Jesus or the apostles for a building fund. But I know from my own experience, you know, that is the most serious giving that Lutherans often do, you know. And oftentimes I had one congregation where I knew I was, before I came, one of the members bragged to me, the heaviest contributor. He said, well, the last pastor when we got tired of them, we all, the small church, we just switched all of our contributions to the building fund. Then there wasn't enough to pay him.
Oh, my.
And he made the mistake of bragging. 7 years later then, I took note. And suddenly the building fund was expanding. And the general fund was decreasing. So then I knew that also I was getting that same message. So it was very interesting.
Admonition, build the house and they will come.
Yes.
Isn't that somewhere in the Old Testament? That maybe a building is how you start these things. It's one way.
It is one way, but I think to get to the idea that the main work of the church is to build buildings is, you're not really finding it in the scriptures. I think the main thing here is the generosity and the love and building the unity and the ministries and then, you know, the building becomes like a vehicle for that. It's not, it's less the, something that's holy unto itself, but more like a tool. And I think that may be more appealing to younger people.
Well, I think you lose sight of the fact that the church, it exists to be in mission. And it doesn't matter how you do that, as long as you, are in mission and being the body of Christ in the world, whether that involves a building or not a building. That's the key thing that we need to, I think, keep in mind as communities, is what is the best way that we can be in mission.
And I think with affluence to that, some people say, or a lot of people, they'll give money but not time. When I look at our congregation, the people I respect most are those who are either down at church or out in the community being the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot easier if you have money to just stick in that light.
Yeah, true. Those who put their lives out there, are greatly to be admired. We're getting down towards the end of our time. I want to look at just a couple things yet. Go to chapter 9, verse 6.
The point is this.
Yeah.
The one who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And the one who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each of you must give as you have made up your mind, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver, and God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work, as it is written. He scatters abroad, he gives to the poor, his righteousness endures forever.
One more verse.
He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness.
All right, let me add, on the personal side, we have one member of our congregation. He often will give a stewardship talk. He's involved in our Synod Stewardship Ministry. But he makes our bishop a little uncomfortable because when he's a tither. And he also sells insurance. So his income is up and down like this, So sometimes he'll have a big offering and sometimes a small offering. But anyway, his argument is a little bit in this neighborhood. Though is it, I'll ask you, or do you think it's precise in this neighborhood? But he is convinced, as like what you were saying earlier, that his tithing is what gives him protection in life. That because he tithes, that God looks after him and brings him blessings from whatever the trouble is. And I just wonder how that sounds to you.
Works righteousness.
Yes, right.
Well, it is a kind of a work. Well, that's what I think makes the bishop uncomfortable, because it does have a certain works righteousness. But here Paul is saying, I think, something. He's saying, if you're, that God is able to, will take care of you. You shouldn't be afraid when you're being generous that somehow you are diminishing yourself. Or... Okay, I'm asking for your personal motivation, Anne.
Well, that doesn't sound like eagerness. That sounds like fear.
Oh, all right. Yes.
And it's not protection. I mean, the protection that Paul's talking about is don't be afraid to give. it's going to be okay, not give so you don't have to be afraid.
Say that again now. I think you're saying you want to flip it, that you give because you're not afraid.
Right.
You don't give in order that you will not be afraid.
Right.
All right.
It's not protection. It's you're giving as a response of receiving a blessing.
Plan. Yes.
It's a response. It's not a necessary.
It's not insurance. It's not insurance.
I was going to say, you have to remember this guy's insurance.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe that colors his outlook. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am, back here. I'm going to come to you.
Where is your faith? Your faith should be in God, that He will take care of you.
Yes.
No.
Not in your good deeds.
Right.
Yeah.
Use what has been given to you to help someone else. You don't do it because of what you're going to get from God, but because God has been generous.
Yes.
And I think that's probably something that most of us don't carry around with us,
mm-hmm.
that thought. You help someone on the street because they need help, and you have needed help yourself. So it's just kind of a pass it on
mm-hmm.
type of thing, not for what I can gain.
So you're saying it's out of your thankfulness and out of your faith, yeah. Yeah. Martha was going to say.
I guess, yeah, similar thing that, you know, it's the first commandment, trust God
yes.
Instead of money to save you. And in a sense, for me, it's kind of like if you hold money lightly and possessions lightly, if they aren't that important to you,
mm-hmm.
which is very hard in this culture,
right.
then it's like, well, of course I've got way more than I need. Why wouldn't I give some of it away? Now, that's hard. That's a hard attitude to have, but that's kind of the one that I find when I'm able to say, okay, I like having some nice things, but really that's not what's most important to me. It's relationship to God, relationship to others. And when I can center in that, then it is a little bit easier to let go of some of my money. To,
yes. When you can stay close to that, those are the things that are really important, yeah.
There's the problem with this verse, I think, is it gets used for a theology of give to get.
Mm-hmm.
So your giving is really an investment. It's not giving. It's not grace in that sense. But I don't think that's what Paul means. I think.
Okay, well, how do you interpret him here?
You're in being in this state of grace, there is that trust in God that your needs are going to be taken care of. And so you put yourself into God's hands in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I would say one of the challenges, even again to that, is God taking care of your needs. There's a lot of people that just don't believe that. I mean, people that lose their house, then lose someone to death because they couldn't afford health care or whatever. I mean, there are so many countless stories of people just saying, God did not provide for me. And so it's interpreting how does God bountifully bless us, you know, and what does that look like? Because there are certainly as many stories as we can think of where God has supplied our needs. There are plenty of others where God
mm-hmm.
hasn't. So.
But don't we understand that God is God and God will provide and you don't always know the plan.
Well, exactly.
But the losing of the house may bring some other blessing.
Yeah. Unless it doesn't. I mean, again, there's people that have just, it's dwindled down to nothing. I mean, people who die of famine, I mean, what does that say of God's providence? And granted, I think it reflects more of humanity than God's heart, but still there's a real problem with trying to work that out in our heads when things just keep going wrong and they never do get better.
I will say, sort of as an observation that I saw when Hurricane Katrina came and destroyed New Orleans, and then in Texas we had a lot of people on television being interviewed down in Houston, where a lot of them came to, and also to Fort Worth. And it was interesting to me how these people who just, you know, had their whole life wiped away so many of them, the first thing when they're interviewing, they say, I just want to give thanks to Jesus because, you know, he's protected me and saved me and helped me through this whole thing. I thought, wow, I was thinking like you, like these people ought to like, you know, why is my life so terrible? Why does God hate me? And, but instead, a lot of them were just the opposite.
Isn't that the attitude we should carry as Christians?
And here's the poor teaching it to the rest of us who are at ease. You know, I thought that was interesting.
Well, it's a theology of the cross. Christ meets us in the midst of our despair. We believe that Christ is there somehow in the midst of the most awful things that could happen to us or the world.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Then when we opened this session, we read that said that Paul and his companions gave because the Spirit led them to.
Yes.
And so we can't forget that part of the picture.
The leading of the Holy Spirit, yes, yeah. To assist each other. Well, I think we're at the end of our session here. I'll just close with I like the hymn, Lead On, O King Eternal, for a couple reasons. One is it's kind of like a military hymn. So you kind of like, you know, you jump up, you know, and you just want to sing it real strong. But then the lyrics are exactly the opposite, you know. I think the second verse, lead on, O King Eternal, till sin's fierce war shall cease. That's a nice one. Makes myself cry. And holiness shall whisper the sweet amen of peace, for not with swords loud clashing, or roll of stirring drums, but deeds of love and mercy, the heavenly kingdom comes. I'll leave you with that. Amen. Thank you for your attention this morning.